Baroque music or Baroque styled music with a harpsichord in the background and the like. And part of this I attribute, and I think it's really a great benefit of recording, to the impact of long playing records on our culture. Now, to understand all of these changes and what has happened, and to understand perhaps the differences that exist between the CD today and the LP, let us say, circa 1951, when it had been in existence for about 3 years, we have to go back and look at a little history. And I was part of that history. I began collecting records when I was in high school in the middle and late 1940s. And what is going to follow is partly personal, since it involves my own experience as a record collector, as a very young man in New York, thoroughly subjective, and I suppose in many respects, utterly unscholarly. But I think it will make a number of significant points that will apply to many of you who have been active as collectors for many, many years, whether it be in New York, if you were in New York as I was. Some of the things I will refer to you will, of course, be familiar with. But there may well be analogous situations in wherever you had been collecting. The first thing that was fascinating in terms of changes that have evolved in the last three decades is the way you buy a record. When I began collecting classical recordings about 1947 or 1948, my very first purchases were made by simply walking in the neighborhood where I lived in Upper Manhattan to a local record store. And the first two sets I bought, the first one was the Victor album DM 317, the Beethoven Seventh Symphony with Toscanini and the New York Philharmonic. Shortly after having purchased that, I had heard on the radio a piece called The Spring Symphony by Robert Schumann, and I liked that, and I wanted to buy that too. And bear in mind, at the time, I'm about 15 years old. So I walked over to the local record store again and asked him if he had The Spring Symphony by Robert Schumann, and he checked and said, "No, we don't have that Schumann symphony, but we have another symphony. Would you like to hear it?" So I said, "Sure." So he pulled the records out, and he had a little record player there. It sounded rather good. It had Zenith printed across the speaker grill, and he put it on, and I said, "Gee, that sounds nice." So I walked home with the Fourth Symphony of Robert Schumann, performed by the Minneapolis Symphony Orchestra under Eugene Ormandy. And the whole idea of you could walk into a store and listen to records is something that someone like my son, who is 14 and a half years old, can't quite understand. And of course, this existed on a much larger scale. Very quickly, I discovered a wonderful Saturday afternoon activity, which was getting on the A train, going down to Macy's, and going up to the fifth floor, and there were all of these 78 records all spread around. You could pick up two or three albums and go into a listening booth and listen. And my friends and I caught on to this, and we'd go down and we'd listen. Now, the trick was, of course, you were also expected to buy. And sometimes we had money to buy, and many times we didn't. And there was a man, I remember him, I can visualize him so clearly. He had red hair, he wore glasses, and he spoke with a heavy German accent. He always kind of looked at you like, "You're going to buy that?" You're just listening. And of course, we were just listening. But it was a wonderful way to acquire a familiarity with the repertory and with records. And then we discovered something else as we got a little bit older. Not only could you listen in a store like Macy's, which was, of course, nothing but a department store, but you could also listen in a store like Liberty Music Shop, for example, where there were very knowledgeable salesmen who would talk to you about music. Or you could go to the Record Collectors Exchange and see all the rare records that you couldn't afford to buy, or go up on Lexington Avenue to the Record Hunter, where if you had 25 bucks, you could buy the New York Philharmonic recording with Willem Mengelberg of the Eroica Symphony, which had been out of print for a long time. And there, too, people would let you listen, and they would talk to you and so forth. Then there was another wonderful store where I worked for a while on 44th Street between Madison and Fifth Avenue called Elaine Music Shop. And if you didn't know the store, I'm sure you were familiar with some of the records that came out under the EMS label and introduced people like me to Edgar Varese and the Brussels Pro Musica Antiqua. That store was run by a wonderful man named Jack Skernick, who had graduated from Harvard and could have pursued a number of professional careers, but because he loved records and he loved music, opened a record store. I'll come back to people like Jack in a minute because I think they're terribly, terribly significant. But all of this existed with this 78 RPM record. This was the scene. There were stores where you could listen, stores where you could shop, and most of all, when you discovered them, stores where people would come and talk to you about records and music and tell you why something was good and why they liked it. Then the LP came along, and of course, it was terribly, terribly exciting, and everybody wanted to get them, and I did, my parents did, and shortly after the LP arrived, we bought that famous Columbia player for, it started at $29.95. We waited just long enough, we got it for a little bit less, and thrown into the bargain were two LPs, which we chose, if I remember correctly, the Beethoven Ninth Symphony with Eugene Ormandy, with the fourth side having the Leonore Overture No. 3 conducted by Paul Kletsky. But the 78s hung around, and they got discounted. If you remember, 50% off was the quotation in many stores. And you could go down to Macy's again, and you didn't need so much money, and you didn't have to feel guilty. Because now you could go in, and instead of spending $7.25 for the Beethoven 7th Symphony, you could buy it for half of that. It was even cheaper than buying the LP. The Beethoven 7th on LP, when they first came out, was $4.85. The half price on the 78s was less. Similarly, that Schumann 4th Symphony, which I bought for $4.85, came on LP, a 10-inch LP with George Sell for $3.85, but if you bought it on the 78, you could pick it up for $2.50 or something like that. This was all very nice. Now, while all of this was happening in this country, as you may recall, people in Europe were not so quick to jump on the LP bandwagon, and 78s were still coming out, and this still caused a few problems. At the time, there was a wonderful classical music station in New York. I still think in many ways it's the most interesting classical music station New York ever had. It operated on a frequency of 99.5, and its call letters were WBAF, not WBAI, but WBAF, and it was owned by Ira Hirschman. And WBAF published a program magazine, and at some point, they got the very bright idea, as partly as a promotion for the magazine, that it would be a good idea to include record reviews in it. And they got a critic to write some reviews for them, and he wrote a review of a performance of the Beethoven Ninth Symphony, and he said it was like nothing he ever heard before. He says there is white heat in these grooves, and it is a performance not to be missed. And the conductor of that performance, and it was recorded in Europe, and it was on 978 RPM discs, was somebody totally unheard of in this country by the name of Herbert von Karajan. David, did I get the white heat correctly? Do you remember?
I don't remember the
word. Oh, it was David Hall's review, and it has stayed with me to this day. Ultimately, of course, that performance turned up on LP, too. Now, about this time, when records were being discounted, the 78s, in many stores at 50%, some stores at less. There were stores at the time, those of you who've lived in New York, there were stores like the Vigas and Vims that carried a large supply of classical records. They were selling them at about 25% off. But then suddenly, one day, there was a small ad in the New York Times. I don't know quite how much it took up. But it said 30% off on all 78s. And the name of the store, I'd never heard of it, said Sam Goody. And it gave an address on 9th Avenue. I don't remember the number, but I remember specifically that it was on the west side of 9th Avenue between 55th and 56th Street. And it's very interesting to consider for a moment who Goody was vis-a-vis such people as Jack Skernick, Willie Lerner, Herman Lemberg, Bob Staub, now, all of those other people were people who worked in the record business and genuinely loved records. They're very much, the way I think of them, is people very much integrated, as one of my favorite writers, E.M. Foster, would define an integrated person. They did not make a separation between work and play. Their work was their play, and their play was their work, and this is the way they wanted it, and this is the way they tried to lead their professional lives. They certainly tried to make money, and some of them did. Some of them were better at it than others, but they did care deeply about records and music. When Goody became famous, and I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but it fits here, Look magazine did a big article on him, and at the time, roughly about 90% of his business was classical, and he very openly and directly said in the article, "I hate 98% of what I sell." Goody was, in contrast to these other people, a businessman. He had been in the haberdashery business prior to getting into the record business, and is that Sam? You'll get yours. You heard me. He'd been in the haberdashery business prior to getting into the record business, and prior to being in the haberdashery business, he had been in a business that was euphemistically called the novelties business. I really can't clarify the euphemism, but if any of you are interested, it would be inappropriate at a banquet, but you can speak to me afterwards, and I'll be happy to tell you what it was. This was a very different breed of person, yet he was a very imaginative businessman. He'd been mainly a supplier, and I had gone down there. At this time, it's about 1949, and I'm 16 years old, and I wanted to see what 78s he had. And lo and behold, in contrast to a store like Macy's and a few other stores I was going to, he really had an extraordinary supply of interesting things. He had, for example, a performance of the Beethoven Ninth Symphony that I had always heard played on WNYC in New York and was never able to find. And he had it at 30% off. It was, of course, Columbia MM227, the 1935 Weingartner recording. He was selling these things left and right. I remember very clearly, he worked with his brother. Many people don't remember, he had a brother named Ed Goody. And one day I heard him yell across the "Hey, Ed, bring up another 30 Weingartner ninths." The LP was here, but those recordings were still almost literally melting out of the store. Well, I bought a number of 78s there, and I went to a high school on Lower East Side in Manhattan, and I lived on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and it was very convenient for me, particularly since the high school had split session, and I was having the morning study. I'd be through at 12:45. I'd get off the A train at 59th Street and mosey over to Goody's, and one day I very timorously walked up to him and said, "Do you give discounts on LPs too? And what do you do?" And it was, I'm not exaggerating, in no way hyperbolic. I said, "I go to high school." "Where do you go to high school?" I go to Stuyvesant High School. "What does your father do?" And it went on like this for about 2 minutes. "Come with me." And he took me up to the desk and said, "Write this man a card." There was a little blue card with some kind of gobbledygook written on it. I don't know what the heck it was. He said, "This is your card. When you want to get a record at 30% off, just show this card." And this was lovely. Suddenly, I discovered I could get a discount on the LP, and this made things much cheaper. And of course, I was much more anxious to buy LPs when I could than I was of 78. There's only one problem. Goody had maintained the privilege, if that's quite the right word, of permitting you to audition the 78 album before you took it home. But he wouldn't let you do this with the LP. As an alternative to that, however, he said you may take the record home and play it once. If you don't like it, you may return it. Well, that sounded fair enough. That was very nice. I took the records home, and some things I knew, and there were some recordings I wanted to hear, and this gave me a chance to audition them, and if I liked them, I kept them, and if I didn't like them, I'd bring them back. Then there was the whole question of playing it once. I did this dutifully about 2 or 3 times, and then I said, "What'll happen if I play it twice?" And I decided to try it. And so I played.
did it twice. And I took it back, and he still accepted it. And another record, I'll play it three times. And by golly, he accepted. This was neat. Hey, I can listen to these things, and when I'm tired of it, I'll take it back. I'll play it 10 times. And this worked for a while, and then some of you may recall that when long playing records first appeared, the paper for the labels was glossy. If you know photographic paper, it was like the high gloss paper of in photographic paper. And then after they had been on the market for about 18 months, 2 years maybe, most manufacturers changed from that high gloss paper to what the analogy again in photographic would be matte paper. It wasn't glossy. And the spindle, you see, if you took the record and you kind of jiggled it around and you found the hole and got it onto the spindle, the spindle would leave marks on that matte paper where, of course, it wouldn't on the glossy paper. And I remember one day I went in with a Westminster recording of the, it was one of those Vienna Concerthaus Schubert performances. I can't remember specifically which one now, but I played it about 9 times. And they took it out and they looked at the label and they said, this has been played more than once. And I decided the only thing to do was to lie. I said, no, it hasn't. And see where this, I said, oh yes, it's only been played once. And this went back and forth a couple of times. And finally the woman behind the counter said, if it was only played once, you wouldn't have Ellis Moore. And she clued me in on what to do so as not to reveal that it had been played only once. To this day, when I put a record on the turntable, I am very careful as a matter of habit to make sure the spindle pierces the center hole immediately without rubbing on the label. I can't control it. It's a kind of reflex that I've developed. Well, Goody, of course, is important for a number of other reasons, and I'd like to stay with him for a minute because, in effect, what we got with Goody, he stayed in 9th Avenue until December of 1951, and then business really got him. He was gradually, because he was offering this 30% discount, which was illegal, bear in mind, and we'll come to this. The LP records were fair traded and were not supposed to be sold at discount. Goody risked a lawsuit from Columbia, at the time Columbia, which ultimately took place and which he won. I'll come to that in a moment. But he risked a lawsuit, and in the process of taking this risk, he literally sucked out a major portion of the classical clientele in New York. I worked for Jack Skernick very briefly in 1952 when I was in college. He was really a lovely, lovely man. I learned a lot from him, and I liked him very much. And he, at one point, confessed to me that had he been more savvy as a businessman, he would have been wise to give discounts on the LPs immediately. He was afraid to do it, partly because they were fair traded, and partly because he thought he might lose money. What he lost was a tremendous number of customers, which he never regained, even when he began to give discounts. Ultimately, he lost the business, he had a heart attack, and he died. And I can't help but feel that part of that was from the pressure of simply not being able to survive in the kind of excessively, perhaps, competitive business operation into which the presence of Sam Goody had transformed the whole business of selling records. Goody prided himself on stock. He moved into this new store and he prided himself on stocking every LP album that was available. He said, even if the company has only one recording, we'll stock it. And there was one company that had only one recording that was in relatively large demand. The company, you may recall, was Oceanic, and they came out with the very first recording of Beethoven's Fidelio. And everybody wanted a recording of Fidelio, and they came into Goody's, and Goody had it. He also, for a while, hired personnel who, like people who worked at Record Collectors Exchange, Music Masters, Liberty Record, Liberty Music Shops, and so forth, liked records. And you could go in there and get advice about what to buy and so forth. He stocked records by company, so you could go to the Columbia section and immediately see what new releases came out, the RCA section and see what new releases came out. And this was very exciting to people my age, late teens, early 20s, who were getting very, very much interested in buying, collecting records, and learning more and more about music. He also maintained you can take it home and listen to it once policy, which was very helpful. It would become more and more impractical, obviously, to let people listen in the store. The store was too large, the records there were too large, and the LPs, although they weren't breakable, the 78s were far more damageable by inferior equipment that might exist in the store. He brought a suit, Columbia brought a suit against him, and he won the suit. The suit, of course, was for selling the records illegally, and the basis for his having won it was that he argued that Columbia had been promoting the sale of its 78 RPM records at huge discounts, that the inconsistency made no sense, and it made a mockery of the fair trade law, and on the basis of that, he won the suit, and then everybody began discounting records. And records got cheaper and cheaper. And by 1955, when the prices had soared, and I say that somewhat sarcastically and ironically, to $5, I think, and 45 cents, or maybe they were up to $5.95 by then, RCA and then all the other companies cut their prices in half. And by this time, I was no longer working at a Lane Music Shop, but I was working at Goody's. And I remember the first of two huge, huge record, or the second of two huge record lines I encountered. I was working there, and when the prices fell in half and Goody was still offering a discount, a line formed. They could not let people into the store anymore. It was much, much too crowded. And a line formed outside, those of you who know Goody's at all, the old store that was on 49th Street between 8th Avenue and Broadway, a line formed outside the store, extended down to Broadway and slightly around the corner, and people would be let into the store as they moved out. It was a terrible situation inside the store, and I was exhausted, and I really wanted to go home. And he came up to me and says, "What's the matter, Normie? You tired?" He always called me Normie, and I couldn't quite figure out why. And he said to me, "You want to go on Screeno?" Now, all of you may wonder what. All of you may. Somebody knows. Some of you may wonder what Screeno was, as some of you may have wondered what happened to those records that were brought back that were played only once or were put very carefully on the spindle 3,000 times. They went to Screeno. Screeno was Goody's code name for returned records, and Screeno was a cage, literally a cage, in the basement where some poor person sat reconditioning the returned records to make them look as if they were new. And I really didn't want to go to Screeno. I didn't really want to be called Normie either. But that's another story. Goody became, I suspect, I have not checked this, this is a thoroughly unscholarly talk. I suspect Goody became what was in effect the first record supermarket in this country. I don't know when Rose Records starts, but I'm pretty certain that Goody preceded Towers. And obviously it changed the whole business of the way the record is marketed. The Record Collectors Exchange folded. They couldn't survive. They sold off. I remember the other big line was when they decided to sell off all of their rare 78s. And I got down there at 11 o'clock in the morning only to discover that the line had started forming at 5. And there was one person who was at the head of the line. And I won't name him, but he's in the rare book and manuscript business today in New York, and he knew that store inside out. And the minute that store opened at 9 o'clock, he was like a jet-propelled airplane up the stairs. They were on the second floor, and he grabbed, neither of them had appeared on LP at the time, and both had been out of print for some time, two Felix Weingartner recordings, the Pastoral Symphony of Beethoven and Weingartner's recording of his own orchestration of the Hammerklavier Sonata. The other side of the coin, how the scene had changed, of course. And perhaps the more obvious side is the repertory. How many of you have ever asked yourselves how many Bach cantatas were available on disc prior to the advent of LP? How many Mozart concertos were available on LP, on disc prior to the advent of LP, and prior to the advent of LP? And when they were, how readily obtainable were they? Just to give you a case in point, I heard the Mozart D minor piano concerto, the K-466, for the first time when I was about 15 years old on WBAF in the performance recorded by Bruno Walter, who served as soloist and conductor, most of you know it. And it had been issued in this country and had gone out of print. It remained available in Europe on HMV. You couldn't get it here. There'd been an earlier recording with Edwin Fischer, which is long gone, and there was a recording that RCA had done up in Rochester with Jose Torbi as soloist and conductor, and that was hard to find. Well, I desperately wanted to get this, and ultimately, the only way I got it was to go down to the Record Hunter and buy it on four HMVs at a premium price. It was very hard to get. There were no other recordings. Consider, for example, also, and this may seem amazing, and I just came across this recently, that in 1948, when the LP appeared, there had been no recording of the Brahms B-flat quartet, the Opus 67 quartet, available for some time. Of course, there had been recordings. The Lehner recorded it. The Budapest quartet recorded it in 1933. But you couldn't go out and buy it, and people were delighted when the Guillet Quartet made a recording, and I think it came out on the Musicraft label, but I'm not sure. Pardon?
Fox.
Thank you. Memory plays funny tricks. I once spoke about a recording of the Beethoven Seventh Symphony with Leopold Stokowski and his symphony orchestra in print. And a colleague called me up and said, gee, I'd really like to hear that. I said, I don't have it. He says, you bet your butt you don't. Of course, it didn't exist. I had made it up. I thought it existed. If it didn't exist, it should have existed. It was something that should have been done at the time. Also, Westminster Records, which of course had started as one of those young companies, had, I don't know quite what to call it, it wasn't a contest, but they asked people, and this is again around 1950, 51, maybe 49, to submit a list of the pieces they would most like recorded, most like to have available on LP. And they would record the three pieces that got the most number of votes. I can't remember the third piece, but one was, perhaps surprisingly, the third piano concerto of Beethoven. And as you may recall, the Schnabel recordings had been out of print for some time. Again, there was a domestic recording with Jose Torbi, which many people didn't think very much of. And there was the disaster in Studio 8H with Toscanini and Rubinstein. So that didn't leave very much of a market unless one wanted to buy the Solomon 78 recording that he made with Sir Adrian Bolt. So that was one. The other one was Mozart's Symphony No. 37. Everybody wondered, why? There's Mozart, a lot of recordings of 35, 36, 38, 30, no 37. Of course, most people don't read the Kerschel catalog, and most people didn't know that, of course, the Mozart Symphony No. 37 is not by Mozart, but by Michael Haydn, and it has only an introduction that Mozart probably wrote. But Westminster went ahead and recorded it anyway. And many people were terribly disappointed to discover they didn't get what they bargained for. Well, also, of course, and this is the most obvious thing, the LP, I think, and perhaps some of us take this for granted today, we don't think about it that much. The LP, I'm sure, must have catalyzed our interest in Berlioz and Mahler, and to a lesser extent, perhaps Bruckner, because the LP was made for composers like this. I think for a whole number of reasons, major Berlioz works wouldn't have fared well on 78s, and you remember the Mahler symphonies that we did have on 78s and the potential hernia they could cause in carrying them around. Obviously, with the LP, it became much easier. Goody became the prototype for a whole number of stores. There were Corvettes in New York, which of course no longer exists, marketed records in a similar fashion, and the small record store became almost non-existent. And stereo came along about a decade later, And I'm not sure I fully understand the whole impact of stereo to this day, but it seems somehow to coincide with the decline of not just the classical music business, because I think in some ways it declined with the LP, but it somehow, the lack of sales, the lack of interest, goodies sales became more and more devoted to non-classical material, and records no longer were even marketed in a store like Goodies in the same way. Suddenly there were bins with composers and artists. They weren't stocked by company. It became obviously much, much harder for a small producer, say somebody like Seymour Solomon, who started Vanguard Records, to get into the act if he wanted to. I can't remember. I've been trying desperately, and I didn't look it up, the name of the man, doctor, who started Westminster. Suddenly Tower came. When Tower came to New York, we thought it was filling a vacuum. I'm not quite sure it has. And I remember the culture shock I and my wife had last summer when we happened to be in London when the Tower had just opened. And since we were near Piccadilly Circus, I figured, let's go in, let's see what it's like. And I knew Ray Edwards, and I thought I'd wish him luck. And I remembered the rather elegant Swan and Edgar that had been in the spot now occupied by Towers. And the onslaught of sound when we walked into that store, regardless of what the sound involved, was so deafening and so horrible, I couldn't take it, and we walked out. Enter the CD, and this is the thing that I think is interesting. The CD has been with us now for 3 years, and I think has been far more successful than many people anticipated. And obviously, in some ways, I think perhaps they're superficial ways, there are parallels between where we are now with the CD and where we were with the LP. But there are, I think, in many ways, far more differences. Consider, for example, the cost of a player. The first CD player I had, which has subsequently broken down beyond, I think, repair, cost $1,000. Compare that, it was a top-of-the-line machine from one of our major companies. Compare that to the $29.95 that the LP player cost in 1949, and the subsequent reduction of that $29.99 to, I think, $9.99 a year or so later. The records are more expensive now than they were then. LPs made buying music easier because it made the purchase of records cheaper. The compact disc costs more, and I know several people who would love to have CDs, but who have avoided buying a player, not because of the price of the player, now obviously they have come down, but because as yet the price of the CDs is not comparable to that of the LPs. Also, we will never, I don't think, for a long time, if at all, manage to encompass the repertory on compact disc that we developed on LP. And the excitement that many of us as listeners experienced in hearing. The first time, for example, I heard the Bach cantata BWV 79, Gott der Herr Sonnenschild, I was terribly shaken. I had never heard music like this. I had never heard it in church. And to hear a recording of it, that Deutsche Grammophon recording that appeared in 1954, was to me simply breathtaking. It actually came out a little earlier in 52 on an American Decca record, if I remember correctly. Also, now in the CD era, I think it's even less likely that we are going to get the kind of company that evolved in Vanguard or Westminster or a number of other independents in the early 1950s. Remember when you could go, as I think Roland Gillette put it so well in the fabulous phonograph, you could go to Europe with a tape recorder and a microphone and you had a recording company going for you. Those days are gone forever, I think. And then there's another interesting difference between the compact disc and the LP. And that's the question of accessibility. I wonder sometimes, and I really don't know the answer to this, if perhaps the compact disc is not too accessible. I have a Discman home, which I'm very happy with, and I got as a Christmas present from my family. But I know people, and I use it because I have a system upstairs and a system downstairs, and it's into one of the systems. But I know people who take this on their bicycle. It goes with them in their car. The disc you buy today, the compact disc you buy today, is in effect different from any of its predecessors in the sense that it's an all-purpose purchase. You may play it at home on your $10,000 system. You may play it in your car. You may play it on your bicycle, or you may take it with you to the summer for Cape Cod, but it goes everywhere. And it helps to contribute to what we might call, or what I sometimes consider, the excessive omnipresence of music. Also, there's the question of the quality. Now, I have no intention of disparaging compact discs vis-a-vis LPs. I think the quality is, at their best, is extraordinarily good, and I think it's going to get better and better. I think ultimately we will have a kind of breathtaking fidelity from them. My question is, do we want this? Do ultimately we want a symphony orchestra in our listening room at home? Does it work? I'm not sure it does. Maybe it does for some. I don't know if it does for me. Everything now is, I think, more impersonal than ever. Yet I must confess that yesterday I took a walk down to the Serenade Music Shop here and discovered something that I don't think quite exists in New York, a store where people still do indeed genuinely like music, know the repertory, know what's available, and like talking about it. A store that does not have music blaring at you, even though it sells every kind of record from hard rock to Josquin des Prez. And it's nice to see. I still think a store like that is terribly atypical of what the scene is. Now, this raises some questions, and I'd like to end with this, if I can. Where are we going? What's going to happen? Some time ago, Jacques Barzin pointed out that the advent of the long playing record had done for music what the development of the printing press has done for the written word. And basically, I think he's absolutely right. Phonograph records have created a kind, and I grant you it is a special kind in some instances, but nonetheless a kind of very valid musical literacy that would have been impossible 100 years ago. It just couldn't have been. The kind of familiarity that many people have, and not just a casual familiarity. You can develop a close familiarity with a piece even if you're not a trained musician and know what's happening. And I, despite the fact that I have had musical training, both on instruments and theory and in everything else that musical training is supposed to involve, I do acknowledge that a person can be untrained and nonetheless intelligently responsive to music. And this intelligence and this responsiveness, and we might call it, for want of a better word, this taste, has been produced by the advent of the phonograph record. There are those people, of course, who disagree, and if you read a book that Michael Gray referred to last night that has a rather, I think, misleading title called Understanding Toscanini, you will find an author who has a very different point of view, and one that perhaps in some ways is worth considering. But I'd like to consider something else, perhaps as a kind of summation. I teach a course to undergraduates in fiction, and the big concern of the undergraduates is how relevant, and I put the word relevant in quotes, that fiction will be. It's got to be of our time. We have to understand it. And one of the most difficult things I have to point out to them is that people don't change, and consequently, it's the Old Testament is as relevant as a novel that has been written only last year, because people's needs, desires, motives, and everything else have been for 5,000 years in many ways constant despite the superficial changes in the externals of their life. It's very easy, I think, to poo-poo electronic music. When I say electronic, I should say electronic reproduction of music. I don't mean electronic music. That's obviously something quite different. And you might argue, as Joseph Horowitz has argued, that this leads ultimately to something like a performance of the Brahms First Symphony under Georg Solti at Carnegie Hall being more like a recording than a concert as a result of the impacts on recordings in our century. This may be true, but There's been a very interesting rebuttal to that theory, published just last week in the New Republic by Harvey Sachs. And he refers to a book that I have never read, but I have every intention of now reading, called Music in Biedermeier Vienna, where he speaks about all of the crazy things that went on during the concert, in concert life in Beethoven's day. Violinists giving virtuoso performances on one string, and some of you may recall, of course, that famous arrangement of the Semiramide Overture for 8 solo pianos, which doesn't seem to me to be any better than that synthetic performance that Sir Georg may have led at Carnegie Hall that Joseph Horowitz heard. The point is that we're all imperfect as people, and this imperfection is going to come out regardless of whether it's in dealing with the phonograph or anything else. Ultimately, you might argue, well, perhaps we should have a moratorium on recording, particularly on recording, let us say, like the Beethoven symphonies and all of the popular repertory. There's many times, as a critic who is responsible on Fanfare magazine for reviewing the Beethoven symphonies, where I genuinely feel, I don't want to hear any more of this performance. I wish I didn't have to listen to it. But we could reason, I think, by analogy for a moment. Let's suppose, just for the sake of argument, that the phonograph had evolved a century earlier, so that essentially we had the beginning of serious acoustic recording at the turn of the 19th century, and that by, let's say, 1833, we had electrical recording going full steam. Now, many of you may recall that famous performance of the Beethoven G major concerto that Robert Schumann wrote about that he heard Felix Mendelssohn play. He said the performance was so beautiful that he was afraid to breathe. It would make perfect sense, of course, that if the phonograph existed at that time, that a record producer would want to record Felix Mendelssohn performing the Beethoven G major, as he well should, and we will assume for the sake of argument that such a recording was produced. Let us then assume that it's a few years later and another producer comes along and says, well, let's see. We've got the Beethoven G major with Felix Mendelssohn. Let's not do it with Franz Liszt. You can imagine what we would have lost in the 20th century. There's going to be deadly recordings. They're probably inevitable. They're going to be made by unimaginative producers making poor judgments. Records will survive. Music will survive. Unfortunately, I can't be sure it will ever be quite the same way it was in 1949 when I started collecting records. Thank you.
Well, I think that that has been a nostalgic look at record collecting that's brought all of us back quite a bit, even those of us who don't go back quite that far, and some people whose collection memories, you know, they don't remember beyond when there were no LPs. And pretty soon our kids are not going to remember to see these big records. That's an uncompact disc, I guess. Nowadays, a lot of the kids don't even think about buying records at all. The compact disc is getting them to buy a disc for the first time. They've been buying those little cassettes. Well, I think we've had a very successful conference this year, and because of our scheduling, the banquet now is the closing item. I'm reluctant to end it, but I guess we do have to. So, we'll see you next year, possibly Toronto. We'll let you know in a couple of months as to when and where it will be. And so until next year. If people are interested, by the way, Ed, we're going to have a rump session. Fred will give another showing of the videotape that was done, an interview with him from one of the educational stations over in Thurston Hall, maybe half hour or so from now.